well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with Jim Wallace with the Gun Owners Action League, but in this particular conversation, we're going to focus more on what Jim's work with the NRA Board of Directors has been like in recent months and in the months ahead, and how you actually can be a part of those efforts. We've talked, I think, quite a bit about the efforts to reform the NRA in recent years. And, as I told Jim, I make no secret about my position. I am not a neutral, unbiased observer here. I want to see a strong NRA. I believe we need a strong NRA. I encourage and support those reform efforts. I try not to use this platform to stump for those changes. I believe a professional obligation to support every pro-Second Amendment organization that is out there doing good work. But when I heard from Jim about some of the specifics that he's been involved in, I did think it was worth bringing to the attention of both NRA members and non-members, frankly. Those gun owners who say, I'm not going to rejoin the NRA until they fix all these problems. Those efforts are ongoing, and a lot of changes have already been made, but there are more changes to benefit the organization and ultimately the members as well, because the organization exists because of its members, not because of the board of directors, not because of the senior staff, not because of the EVP or the head of NRA ILA. The NRA is nothing without its members. And in order for the NRA to be as strong as possible, in order for any gun rights organization to be as strong as possible, you need a strong and active membership base. So, with that in mind, I thought it was worthwhile to talk with Jim about one of the ongoing efforts to reform and modernize the National Rifle Association with an eye towards increased accountability and transparency for the members itself. Take a look and a listen. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Well, good to be seen. I don't know if that's going to happen this weekend. You probably won't see anybody for days.
Nobody's going to see me either, because I'm anticipating our power is going to be out for several days. Stocked up. I've got my non-electric heat source. I've got plenty of water and food. So we'll be okay. It'll be uncomfortable, but we'll be all right.
Well, if you're typical New Englander, milk and bread, right? Milk and bread.
Exactly.
That gets you through anything.
Right? Yeah. Unfortunately, my kids ate like half the supply of emergency bread that I bought. I'm like, you gotta ration this out. What are you doing? So I gotta make one more run to the store and we'll see what's left on the shelves. Yeah. All right. So, normally we have you on, we're talking about stuff going on in Massachusetts with the Gun Owners Action League, but today we're talking about what's going on with the National Rifle Association. You are on the board of the NRA, and tell me what's going on. There are a lot of efforts to reform the organization, provide more accountability, transparency, so that members, again, can trust what's going on with this organization. And part of this effort is to change the bylaws of the NRA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, to back up a second, you remember that old movie, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum?
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing happened on the way to the NRA board meetings. About 2 weeks prior to the meeting, I had been vice chair. I wasn't actually on the board anymore, but I was vice chair of bylaws because, unfortunately, I know how to do that thing, and I mentioned that. So I get voluntold. But 2 weeks before the meeting, I get a call from Secretary John Fraser, and he says, "Hey, Jim, we had yet another resignation." And I don't even know what that's up to now. It's got to be close to 25 people have abandoned ship. So he goes, "Do you mind being on the board for a meeting?" And I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to be there anyway. I'll do it. But if this is another 13-hour meeting, I'm tapping out." But luckily it wasn't. So I fly down on a Wednesday, and Thursday morning I wake up, check my email, and there's a flurry of emails from NRA staff. Well, apparently the chairwoman resigned from the board Wednesday night, so I woke up to be chairman with a meeting at 8:30.
Oh, geez.
So it's like I said at the board meeting, I feel like the used car of the NRA board. I show up here and there. But anyway, So at the board meeting, General Hagen actually filed a resolution to completely rewrite the bylaws, which is something I've been saying for 2 years. As a matter of fact, Mike Harris, our public policy guy here at Goal, who you've had on the show many times, mm-hmm. when I first showed him the NRA bylaws quite a while ago, he described it as a series of dirty Band-Aids over an injury nobody could remember. And I said, yeah, that's about right. Yeah. Wow. And I foolishly did a deep dive on these things over a year ago, and I happened to talk about it, and they said, okay, guess who's in charge of bylaws now? And I'm like, dang it. But it's very clear when you read through them, and they're so convoluted and so stacked amongst each other and shotgun spread subject. They were completely designed to stifle the board and also reward loyalty. Things like, why would you put your meeting agenda in your bylaws? You don't know what your meeting's going to be like, you know, in 2 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. Why would you list every single little committee? There's over 40 committees all in the bylaws. Again, you don't know what you're going to look like in 2 years. Why would you list all of those committees in the bylaws? So even things like that are member protected, if you look at the bylaws, anything that's in bold, italicized print are pieces that only the members could change. Well, back when Wayne stepped down at that infamous meeting in January, mm-hmm. I and others, because we literally walked out of that meeting without a plan. And I and others said, hey, excuse me, what's the plan? And I said, we need to hold an emergency board meeting. And they said, well, you can't. And they said, well, why not? Well, the bylaws say because the executive vice president stepped down, if you hold a meeting, you have to elect a new one. And they said, well, we're not prepared for that. Exactly. So you can't have a meeting.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh, okay. This has all been rigged from day one. So, yeah.
Well, maybe not from day one, probably not going back to 1871, right? But rigged for some time, let's say.
It probably in my adult lifetime or at least the last couple of decades. But yeah. It's very clear that they were not well thought out, but well thought out in the terms of stifling any kind of change or movement without the approval of the hierarchy. And it's just one of those things, like even, electing your executive vice president. He had a contract. Why were we electing him every year? What's going to happen if we didn't elect him every year? So even all of the other officers, you know, the treasurer, the secretary, whatever, compliance officer, although that's new, we were supposed to elect them. So moving forward, if you're going to attract talent, high corporate executive talent, they're not going to stand for an election. Well, that's just foolish. Mm-hmm. So there's all these little things, changing. Right now, President Bill Bakkenberg, he should be chairman of the board, not president. You know, Doug Hamlin should be president CEO. So there's a lot of those changes that need to take place. So what our plan is, the bylaw committee, and we've got a good group of people, is basically forget about what's there now.
Okay.
You know, we'll have to copy and paste things that, you know, obviously are transferable. But forget about what is. We need to look to the future and say, what do we need as a solid base for bylaws? And I'm a big believer, and so are other experts that I've consulted with, bylaws should be very simplistic. They should be almost boilerplate, because the more complex you get in your bylaws, the easier it is for you to get tripped up by your own bylaws and be in violation of them. So they should be very basic, very easy to understand. Everything else should be in policy, should not be in bylaws. So our goal, we hope, is We have the upcoming annual meeting, mid-April, I think. And so our goal as the bylaws committee right now is to gut this thing, start from scratch, you know, pull over what we need to pull over, and basically build what I call a foundation. We're going to build the foundation of this as best we can with everybody's help. And then we're going to try to present it to the board in April. It won't be for a vote. It'll just say, here's the foundation. Okay, now let's finish the construction. What else do we absolutely need in here? Or are there things that we can still take out and deal with in other manners? Because one of the things I've been preaching ever since this was handed to me was, because the board was so stifled, it really didn't know how to act as a board, because they never had any responsibility. It was all taken away from them. And their job was just to sign off on things. So not everything needs to be spelled out in your bylaws. You have to start acting like a board would act.
Yeah.
And some of that is going to be an education on the part of a lot of people, because we're going to have to tell them, hey, you don't need everything spelled out for you. You're an adult. You're on a board of directors of a major corporation. You need to start learning how to do that. And I understand it's a learning process.
Right.
But that's what's going to have to happen. Now, once we get that foundation, we'll present it to the board, again, not as a vote. And what we're hoping is between the April and, let's say, June, they will give the committee input, and we will go through that input, see what needs to go in, what doesn't need to go in. Maybe some more stuff can come out. And then put something formal together as a presentation or a resolution for the September meeting, which means it has to be mailed out to the board members 30 days prior.
Okay.
At the September meeting, we hope to have a formal vote on the drafted package of bylaws. And it can be amended on the floor. A lot of things can happen to it. I always say everything's a draft until it's not, right? You know, ask Thomas Jefferson, everything's a draft until it's not. How many amendments to the, you know, Constitution? But then if they approve something, it will go out to the members, because there's a complete redraft has to go to the members for a vote.
Okay.
And hopefully that'll get done for, you know, the elections in 2027. So this takes quite a long time. Anything we put before the members takes over a year. So, and it's expensive. Right now, it's about $100,000 to put something before the members, because it all has to be mailed out, at least currently. We're hoping that we can start getting elections and everything, you know, on the web at some point. Who knows when, but hopefully we can do that.
Well, and that's, you know, that's a challenge. I mean, I know that, you know, even with the NRA publications going quarterly, you know, there's been a lot of consternation from folks who, you know, received their magazines in the mail for monthly for, you know, decades, and don't like that change. And so I imagine that, you know, moving to an online voting system would, you know, you'll find some members objecting to that, too, I'm sure. But, you know, as you guys are going through the bylaws now, obviously, again, as you say, at some point this will be presented to the members, but is there an opportunity for members to weigh in at the moment as you guys are looking at making these changes? Can members have input with your committee?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. They can contact us anytime they want if they have ideas. But again, I would caution the members that we want to keep things minimal. Bylaws have to be minimal. And I already know there's folks out there that want to add pages and pages and pages, you know, under the auspices of protecting member rights. And I totally get that, because that's one of our priorities doing this. However, there is a point, and I hate to say this, but there is a point, you can put anything you want in a bylaw. If somebody wants to conduct themselves in a criminal way, it's going to happen. So the bylaws, you know, to some extent, it's like gun control laws, right? Gun control laws don't stop criminal behavior. They only hurt us. They only restrict us. So we want to put together a set of initial bylaws that will allow the board to do its job, allow the board to have appropriate oversight, but also protect the member rights. And keeping in mind, even if the members do vote on a package in a year now, they can still be changed. This is just the beginning. We call it bylaws 2.0. And it should be refreshing to the members and the board members alike to not have to be micromanaged by a set of bylaws that never should have been put in place.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, the goal here is to, as you say, simplify the bylaws, make them easier to read, easier to understand, easier to follow, but also, again, to give the board, to make sure the board isn't just a rubber stamp, right?
Yeah.
But yes, to ensure that the board has the ability to conduct itself the way boards are supposed to and to exercise the oversight that boards are supposed to have, yes, right? So ideally, again, if the board has that oversight, it's going to be operating in the best interest of the members and not the executives. I think that's an important consideration too, right?
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Matter of fact, at least this is a draft. Again, everything's a draft until it's not. But under the draft, all of the separate officers, so, you know, what is Doug Hamlin now? What is John Frazier now? You know, the treasurer, compliance officer, all of those folks would be under the category of salaried officers, and they would all be working under individual contracts. Whatever contract is worked out with that individual person, you know, who knows? It could be a 3 to 5 year contract. There's stipulations about how you get released if you're so all of that stuff would be in their contracts, not in the bylaws. And that's the way it always should have been. There's also going to be a very strict chain of command as far as, you know, the officers, you know, Doug happens to retire, who takes next. So all of that stuff. But again, a lot of details should be policy. Should not be in black and white in the bylaws. Doesn't belong there.
Yeah.
You know, if you're hiring people, that doesn't belong in the bylaws. I don't know how this is going to be received, but it should be received well. The bylaws actually spell out each individual type of membership. Why is that in the bylaws? It should be just the board's job to determine levels of membership and costs. And again, because we're NRA 2.0, we're not sure what we're going to look like in 2, 3, 5 years. So that stuff should not be in bylaws. It should just be part of business. Again, the board learning to do its job and feeling free to do its job. And I will say, Cam, this is the last board meeting we had. It's the first and only board meeting I've ever attended in all the years I've been around. There was actually a little levity in the room. You know, we were very professional. We were getting our job done. But people were actually feeling free enough to kind of joke with each other in the boardroom. That tells you everybody is relaxed. They're able to do their job freely. They're not uptight. Oh, my God, am I going to offend the hierarchy and now I'm out? So it's just the opposite. Sometimes we were sitting whips against each other and it's like, yeah, okay, all right, cool. But that was so refreshing, Cam. The board is learning to be a board.
That is very good to hear. I remember speaking to a board member who shall remain nameless a couple of years ago who described the board, and this was, I think, back in 2024, maybe late 2023, as a den of vipers. And of course, this is still when you very much had, you know, the power struggle, I think, going on between, let's call it NRA 2.0 and the old guard. And, you know, the members have spoken. We saw a reform slate elected last year. And I think that, you know, we're seeing the consequences of that play out. I don't know how much you're free to talk about, but we obviously have seen a number of these board members decamp and depart, as you mentioned. A number of them have ended up over the NRA Foundation. There's ongoing litigation between the NRA and the NRA Foundation. So, you know, that power struggle is still playing out, but not necessarily on the NRA board itself, I think it's fair to say. And I'm, you know, again, I've always been one, I've been very open about my bias here. I want to see a strong NRA. I want to see the NRA succeed. I believe that there was a need for reform. I am glad to see that these reform efforts are taking place, and I encourage them. I'm encouraging people to come back to the NRA and to make the NRA as strong as possible. Again, not every challenge has been addressed, and there are some that are still ongoing, but I think the NRA is in a better place than it was a couple of years ago. I think the NRA board is in a better place than it was a couple of years ago. And I just say that from an outside perspective, but do you agree from a board perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. The board, you know, I keep saying the board is becoming a board, and it's imperative. The interesting thing too is watching the new blood come in, and rightfully so, there's an educational process, and not to disparage gun clubs because I love them, but you can't necessarily bring a small club mentality to a corporate board. So there's a learning curve, and that's cool because it's awesome to see things from new eyes. You know, it's not the same stale point of view, and, you know, they're stifled in their opinion. Just the opposite. You know, we encourage people, even at committee meetings. It's like anybody who's not on the committee but is just sitting around the room, hey, tell us what you think. You know, I always tell my staff here that if you disagree with something I'm doing or saying, you don't tell me, I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be mad.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though don't tell my wife, please, but, you know, I don't know everything. I don't know every perspective. So we're in a constant learning process, and the bylaw redraft, a complete redraft, is part of that learning process, that we are finally free to be who we need to be to get the job done for our members. And that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
You know, right, it's about them.
So if there are members who are watching this, and, you know, they decided to take a look at the bylaws, they've got some suggestions. Again, keeping in mind the principles that you're talking about, mm-hmm. right? We want to simplify. Mm-hmm. We want to make this, you know, easy to understand, easy to follow. How can they get in touch with you or the bylaws committee?
Yeah, I mean, they could just contact me directly through my email. I mean, it's public, so it doesn't matter, but it's just jim@gold.org.
Okay.
And just put NRA bylaws in the subject matter so I know what's coming through.
Okay.
And yeah, I'll be happy to look at anything. And as we move forward, this is going to be a long process.
Yeah.
And to some extent, tedious. But the good thing is, when I was talking to the officers about this task, they said, Jimmy, you got to be able to make this happen. And I said, yes, I can. And the reason is because I've been studying this stuff for more than a year. And I've made so many notes on this about what should be, shouldn't be, and run things by experts, attorneys, everything. So at least we have a general, you know, sense of how to build, again, the foundation to start from.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's the lump of clay, right? You start with a lump of clay and you just keep working on it until you get to where it is. And so I, you know, this is going to be a lot of work, but I'm actually pretty excited because we can move forward as part of NRA 2.0 with the core structure of the bylaws to do the work of the members and to do the work of the board that's working for the members. So I think it's a win-win.
Well, I know we're going to be talking to you between now and the NRA annual meeting about goal stuff, but I'd love to get you on either, you know, shortly before, maybe shortly after you present your proposal to, again, this framework that you're talking about, the foundation to the board. So we can talk about this again and, you know, let members know what's going on. I think it's very important that, and I know that, again, I know that everybody that I've talked to at the NRA, whether they're on the board, they're in the executive staff, really wants to be transparent, really wants the members to understand what's going on. They want to be open about this process. So I'd love to have you back when you're ready to present that to that foundation and talk about a little bit more in specifics. But I also got to ask you before I let you go to put on your goal hat for a second here. And, I'm now looking at an onslaught of gun control bills in Virginia, too many to count at this point. What we saw, obviously, Chapter 135, complete overhaul of Massachusetts gun laws. The court challenge is still underway. The implementation of 135 is still not complete. Are you looking at any bad gun bills this session in Massachusetts, or are they still trying to figure out how to get 135 in place?
I don't think they have the appetite for it this session. And right now, this is an election year, so the part of the two-year cycle, it's the election year. Which, by the way, the governor just came out and said she ordered Fish and Wildlife to conduct listening sessions about how to help hunters with like Sunday hunting and crossbow hunting and setbacks. And it was like, wait a minute, what? And we put it out. It's out there. I mean, it says, what the hell is this? Right on the social media post. So what is that all about? Because she could care less about hunters and obviously hates gun owners. Is it just because the election year? But a lot of us suspect, Cam, the last so-called listening tour.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, actually was used to gain information on how to come after us.
Right.
Not to help us.
Yeah.
So everybody is like, yeah, we're not falling for this one.
When Maury Healey tells gun owners, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Hunters, beware.
Yeah. No, I ain't buying it. So yeah,
government might be wearing some camouflage.
And to make it worse, or at least more suspicious, she gave Fish and Wildlife that order on the same day that the director of Fish and Wildlife retired, and he was the last hunter in the hierarchy. There's no hunters left in the hierarchy.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, yeah, all right, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go. But so, yeah, it's there's a lot going on here. You know, the sad thing here is, too, that because of all the gun laws, the courts, and you should have Mike come on and talk more about this, but the courts have done a reset on precedents for Second Amendment in Massachusetts. They consider everything to be new. All of the old decisions that protected us in the courts, they consider to be gone. So even if there's an exemption in the law, they're making you use that as an affirmative defense in the trial rather than saying, no, we're not going to prosecute this person. So Mike actually came up with the terminology that the process is now the punishment, because even if you win, you lose.
Well, we'll definitely be reaching out to Mike in the very near future. And in the meantime, you know, again, thanks for what you're doing up there in Massachusetts. Thanks for what you're doing on the NRA board. You are, if you're a used car, you're a used Lamborghini, as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Wallace. So, appreciate
I might get in the Lamborghini, but getting out, I may need the fire department.
I'm with you. I'm right there with you. All right, listen, man, thank you so much. And I know we'll be talking again very soon.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Cam.
Jim Wallace joining us here in Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks to Jim for joining me on the program. And, you know, as Jim alluded to during the conversation, and I've mentioned this as well the past couple of days, we are expecting some wicked weather here in Central Virginia. Still don't really know what it's going to look like. The forecast, you know, as of a couple of days ago, calling for like 2 feet of snow. Now that has changed. The snowfall amounts are falling. The potential for freezing rain and ice is on the increase, which is not great. Frankly, I'd rather have 2 feet of snow than a foot of snow and a half inch of ice, but we may be looking at the latter rather than the former. So I am anticipating not having power on Monday. That's what I'm planning for. So if you don't see a Bearing Arms Cam and Company, if you go to bearingarms.com, and I'm not posting any stories. It's Tom Knighton holding down the fort with hopefully some contributions from folks like John Petrolino and Kerry Sloan. That's likely what's going on. I'm still here. I'm just sitting in a freezing cold house. Not freezing cold, because I told Jim I've got a non-electric source of heat. We've got plenty of water on hand. I got my camp stove. I've got to go get some propane this afternoon to fire up the camp stove. But we'll be okay. 4 years ago, we had, I think it was around 15 inches of snow. It was bad. We lost power for 5 days, and it was uncomfortable. Yes, Miss E was around to help out and serve as the camp cook, so to speak. My kids are not going to have that this time around, but the youngest, who are still in the house, and myself, along with the dogs and the barn cats and the chickens, we will be okay. We'll probably be uncomfortable, but we will be okay. And, you know, knock on wood, the power stays on. It's a non-issue. I'm with you on Monday. But if not, that's why. And I will be back just as soon as I possibly can and as soon as as Dominion Power allows me to be back on here. So, all right. With that in mind, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story. our good deed of the day, our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Florida. One of the worst Tallahassee area killing sprees in questions, killing sprees in years sparks questions. And those questions are, why was this guy out and able to allegedly commit these crimes? 54-year-old Flay Rollins, apprehended by U.S. Marshals Service Fugitive Task Force on January 16th, he was a suspect in a murder at the time. He actually had an outstanding warrant for murder with malice out of Valdosta, Georgia. The U.S. Marshals found him at a gas station inside a car with a gun in plain view, seized it as evidence. Rollins, already a convicted felon many times over, was not allowed to legally possess that firearm, but again, also had that outstanding murder warrant out of Valdosta, Georgia. Victim in that case was a male co-worker, according to State Attorney Jack Campbell. But after he was taken into custody, Rollins allegedly confessed to two other murders, both of them women with whom he was romantically involved, according to the state's attorney. Body of one of the women was found later that day at the Richardson Recreation and Retreat Center. Rollins allegedly told detectives he could find the body of the other woman who was pregnant in the Alapsheola National Forest. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. He has since been charged with two counts of murder in Leon County, a single count of murder in Lowndes County, Georgia. And the state of Georgia is pursuing another murder charge in the death of the unborn child. The state's attorney says this is horrible. Single murder is horrible. The murder of an unborn child who couldn't be more innocent. Baby never had a breath. Domestic violence is always particularly dangerous and horrible. Leon County Sheriff's Office, the Lowndes County Sheriff's Office, says all three of the victims passed away from gunshot wounds. And as it turns out, Mr. Flay, as I said, had a lengthy criminal history. He was actually out on bond at the time. Tallahassee Democrat reports that readers emailed reporters asking how he was out on bond and whether or not he should be considered a serial killer if he's convicted. Leon County Sheriff's Office says no, because the murders aren't random, so they're not being investigated as serial killings. But he is a career criminal under the terms of the NCIC, history of arrests and convictions going back three decades. Charges as varied as selling cocaine and possession of a firearm by a felon to aggravated assault and battery. He has spent roughly 18 years in prisons in Florida due to at least seven different felony convictions. But some of the most recent convictions, again, really raise questions about why he was out. So 2018, he was arrested and charged with attempted murder after allegedly stabbing a woman in front of her teenage son. He was convicted, though, on a lesser charge of attempted manslaughter. And in 2019, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. According to records from the Department of Corrections in Florida, he served less than 3 years of that four-year sentence and was released in early February of 2022. About 2 years go by. It's May of 2024. He's then arrested on a charge of aggravated battery with a deadly weapon after allegedly attacking a girlfriend with a box cutter and punching her multiple times in October of 2023. Again, he wasn't arrested until May of 2024 on that case. Despite his lengthy criminal history, despite the multiple felony convictions for violent offenses, some of which were similar to this, right? Leon County Judge Augustus Akins Jr. set his bond at just $10,000. Said no contact with the victim, no weapons or ammunition, which again, he wasn't allowed to legally possess anyway because of his previous felony convictions. But he was able to bond out of the Leon County Detention Facility that same day. In July of 2024, so a couple of months after he was first arrested and then released, the state attorney's office upgraded the charge to attempted second-degree murder with a trial date set for May of this year. The Tallahassee Democrat reports that the court records don't show whether the state asked for a higher bond during his first appearance when bond was set at $10,000. But the state attorney says every day we have people going to first appearance, and if you go and you watch it, we have lawyers asking for high bonds and low bonds. He says this is an example of what happens when somebody gets out who shouldn't have. Now, the state attorney did not second-guess the judge's decision to set bond at $10,000. He said he was an extremely experienced jurist, and he said that if the judge had set a higher amount, the defense would almost certainly have filed a motion seeking to lower it, saying, quote, in my experience, he knew what he was doing. I'm pretty confident the judge had more experience than the prosecutor or the defense attorney. So no matter how great our arguments would have been, Judge Aikens probably was going to set bond. I don't know Judge Aikens. I don't know if he was a tough on crime judge, soft on crime judge. And I'm not an attorney, not a defense attorney, not a prosecutor. But as just an average citizen, I do have to wonder, when somebody who's already spent 18 years in prison, 7 different stints in prison, a rap sheet going back 3 decades, multiple violent offenses, comes before a judge and is charged with yet another violent offense that could have led to the death of the victim. Why is bond allowed? Why is that individual not considered at that point to be a danger to himself and the community? That's my simple question. Forget about bond being set at $10,000. I'm not even sure a $2 million bond would have been appropriate at that point. Because you've got an individual who appears unwilling or unable to function in a free society without violating the laws that we have on the books. And again, we're not talking about writing bad checks. We're not talking about jaywalking. We're talking about multiple arrests on charges of attempted murder. Even if those charges ultimately resulted in lesser convictions for attempted manslaughter, that's still a violent crime, right? So, if the state's attorney is right that, well, this is just the way the system works, well, then the system needs to change. Because I think pretty clearly this guy was a risk to the community. He was a risk to any woman he got involved with romantically. According to prosecutors, 2 of them ended up dead. He allegedly was a risk to his coworkers, because one of them ended up dead too. And this isn't, again, a matter of Monday morning quarterbacking, or I guess Thursday morning quarterbacking in this case. Simply by looking at this individual's previous criminal history, I think any reasonable person would come to the conclusion that, yeah, it's probably not a good idea for this individual to be released on a bond while he is awaiting trial for yet another violent offense. Again, I don't believe that everybody who's charged with a crime should be held without bond. In fact, I'd like to think I'd err on the side of caution and err on the side of freedom. But this doesn't seem to be a particularly difficult case to me. The litany of convictions that this individual had already had on the books, and the nature of those offenses, and the nature of the crime that he was charged with, that alone tells me this individual posed a danger. And if that's not enough to hold somebody until trial, then Florida's got a problem, a real problem. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. Also from Florida. And if Florida has a problem with holding violent offenders, at least Florida respects the right of self-defense. Headline: abduction attempt leads to deadly self-defense shooting in Bradenton, Florida on New Year's Day. And it did not take long for the Manatee County Sheriff's Office to determine that this was, in fact, a case of self-defense. Investigators say that minutes before this shooting on New Year's Day, an individual named Nicholas Palomo attempted to abduct a woman as she was walking her dog in Bradenton, Florida. She was able to run away. Palomo apparently was in a car, kind of pulled up beside her, tried to yank in. She was able to make it back home. She told her husband what happened, and he went outside to confront Palomo. Now, Palomo could have driven away, right? Instead, he stuck around. According to deputies, he began acting in a threatening way before advancing towards the husband, which is when the husband fired a shot at Palomo. Before this incident, investigators discovered that Palomo had caused a disturbance at a nearby convenience store, seemed to be under the influence of drugs, and after reviewing the case, Manatee County State's Attorney's Office determined that the homeowner's actions were justified. Detectives also said that Palomo did have a violent criminal history, including kidnapping in the past. No links to the couple, though, so police believe that this was just a random encounter, right? Palomo driving down the road, maybe under the influence of drugs, maybe not, but for whatever reason, saw that woman, believed that she was an inviting target, tried to grab her off the street. She was able to resist and run away. You know, I guess you could argue, well, why did the husband go out looking for the guy? I guess you could argue that. But if my wife ran through the door of my house and said, some guy just tried to kidnap me, I think I would go outside too. Not necessarily to confront this individual, although maybe. But at that point, I'd be worried about who else this guy might be trying to snatch. You know, I'd tell my wife, listen, call police, let them know what happened. Meanwhile, I'm going to go out there and make sure he doesn't try to grab anybody else. We might have kids playing on the street. Who the hell knows? So I don't think it was unwarranted or unreasonable for the husband to go investigate. I don't think it was unwarranted or unreasonable for the husband to have a firearm on him when doing so. Actually, he's exercising Second Amendment rights at that point. And again, this happened just a couple weeks ago. Police already clearing the husband, so it appears that it wasn't a difficult investigation for the Manatee County Sheriff's Office to determine that, yes, this in fact was a justifiable shooting. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, while unable to do the right thing, a police officer from Wisconsin credited to help save a passenger on a flight to Barcelona a couple of days ago. Madison Police Department said that one of its own, identified only as Officer Voigt, was taking a trip to Barcelona. I said this a couple of days ago. It's actually a little bit longer than that. It's about back last fall. And as he's on board, as he's getting ready to take a nap, he heard a woman a few rows up in the airplane scream for help. Apparently, there was a passenger who was unresponsive, did not have a pulse. Officer Voigt jumped into action, started performing chest compressions. There was also a doctor on board, who was able to find that sort of weak and thready pulse. The doctor, Officer Voigt, then a nurse who was on board the plane as well, used what medical equipment was available there on the plane, along with a coat hanger to hang an IV. The man was able to regain consciousness, said he might have taken too much of his prescription. Voigt, the doctor, and the nurse helped monitor the man's condition over the next 5 hours. When they landed, he was escorted off the plane for further care. According to the Madison Police Department, Officer Voigt handed the doctor and nurse two police challenge coins, not knowing if they handed him anything in return. But hopefully Officer Voigt had an uneventful vacation after that, but in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need. Madison Police Officer Voigt, we thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I really hope I'm back with you on Monday. I certainly do. And not just because I like doing the show, although that is part of it. But yeah, also it would be nice to have power. If, however, I'm not, like I said, I'll be back as soon as possible. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com. In the meantime, today, tomorrow, snow is supposed to hit like late Saturday night. So we'll have stories up for the weekend. Maybe, you know, if you don't see me on Monday, again, Tom Knighton will be holding down the fort. We'll hopefully have some contributions from folks like Kerry Sloan and John Petrolino as well. But we will make sure that you get the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And I will be back with Bearing Arms, Cam & Company just as soon as I possibly can be. Until then, be well, be safe, stay warm, and be free.